Welcome to the Eurointelligence podcast. I'm Wolfgang Munschau, and with me are Susanne Munschenk and Jack Smith. Today, we want to talk about two subjects. The first one is on the theme of the West against the rest and why the rest might find it altogether much more difficult than some commentators have suggested to form a joint anti-Western position or a joint position that's more independent of the West. And our second story is about the backlash against green legislation, starting in Germany in a very forceful way. It's now also becoming a theme in Brussels. Susanne, you wrote about the forthcoming BRICS summit and the difficult strategic choices the leaders of the BRICS are facing, and they're also their internal divisions.
Yeah, the foreign ministers of these countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, came together in Johannesburg to prepare the summit that is going to happen at some point in August. It started from this very loose association, and it turned into a much more ambitious project from the Chinese point of view for fostering trade amongst these emerging economies. Now, with Russia's war in Ukraine, the whole thing turned into a much more politically ambitious project. And the common denominator is to say, what can we do to counter this Western predominance in the world? They all have different flavors to it. And of course, Russia comes from the most squeezed position, in a sense that they have been sanctioned from the West. They've been shunned in all sort of institutions, while other member states of this BRIC bloc still have stakes and they still have relationships with the West to cater for. And one of the examples where it showed up is, for example, they founded a development bank, a common development bank, and this bank had to actually stop its activities in Russia because they were subject to sanctions and they didn't want to compromise their operations in other member states. So we see here there are various degrees of and various shades of the desirability of actually what it means to confront the West. And I think this is, as much as it sounds like the one-liner, it's a much more granulated picture closer by. The other thing is, like, we have Vladimir Putin. It is not even clear that he can attend the summit in August because there is an international arrest warrant, and South Africa, who's a member of the ICC, would theoretically have to arrest him and deliver him. So
they said they wouldn't do this.
It's not clear yet. They said that they're investigating into that and then wait for the report to come out. So there is no formal position on this one yet, but it goes to show how difficult it will be to move on. As I wrote this morning, the big theme, I mean, you talk about deepening, which already has obstacles, but also the widening. We have China pushing for an enlargement, saying we want to be open. We are not exclusive, but inclusive for emerging economies. Of course, their interest is to enlarge the bloc. That might not necessarily be so easy to accept for other countries. If we talk about, for example, accession of Iran, one of the candidates, that might actually throw up a lot of other questions of identities, of politics, what is behind. Can you keep this association on a purely economic basis that implicates also the financing, the question of parallel currencies? Or is there politics that eventually intrudes that building of or that turning BRICS into a much more condensed version or union?
Now, the point about the development bank is very interesting, because even if you have the intention to decouple from the West on trade, and on trade it's likely to be more successful, a development bank is much more interconnected to the financial system. And the Asian Development Bank, it has commercial banks as its clients, it's not just about only about the sanctions, but there is so many the U.S. sanctions, or the biggest part of the U.S. power is through the financial sector, and it sanctions any financial institutions that doesn't play ball with sanctions, and it imposes secondary sanctions on those financial institutions. So there's absolutely no way that a regional financial development bank can extricate itself from this process. This is why the whole initiative that Lula started on the currency, on the separate finance, why this is so important for them. And they're not going to really get anywhere unless they achieve a financial system. We're talking decades here. The extricating yourself away from dollar dependence is not something you can decide. So it needs to be a strategic position that not only Lula pursues, but as you mentioned this morning, what about his successor? It could be Bolsonaro or another character from the other party. So it's not clear.
Oh man, there are too many Brazilian politicians to choose from. Really, it's like it's like the Wheel of Fortune, honestly, or the I guess if you're Brazilian, the Wheel of Misfortune. But you know.
Absolutely. So it's difficult, and I think this is good that we sort of highlighting this issue, because you know it's not this is not like a chess game where one party wins or the other party wins or where coalitions are building. So this is we should also remind ourselves how the U.S. became a dominant power, especially in the economic sphere. That went through different phases. One phase was in the post-war period. One phase was through force. This was the 50s, 60s, 70s when they toppled governments and intervened in the way they intervened in Chile and other countries. But the smarter way the U.S. conducted was since the 1990s, when the then developing world, China, India, and Brazil, adopted new development models that were reliant on exports. And the smart thing the Americans did was to absorb these exports and to absorb the saving surpluses and rekindle them. Had the Americans not done that, this model would not have functioned. The entire sort of globalization that we experienced in the last 30 years would not have happened. And for anyone to challenge that and to go against this, the thing would need a system, not necessarily the same system, but it would need something that works. It could be based on force, it could be based on cooperation. But as we saw with the development banks, it needs to have a financial backbone. And that's where I would start.
On force, the question, I think, is one of geography and geopolitics, basically. One of the reasons why the U.S. has, through its modern history, been able to project power so successfully is because, basically, there are no real threats to the U.S. in its immediate vicinity. If you think about the Americas as a continent, nobody is presenting the U.S. with any particular problems there. It has a kind of friendly relationship with both Canada and Mexico since the mid-19th century, when the U.S. basically won a series of wars with Mexico and massively reduced Mexico's power in the region. There's been no real threat to the U.S. there. And that gives it a number of different options for going elsewhere, because you don't have to worry so much about kind of physically defending America. With China, it's different because China is, to put it bluntly, surrounded by countries that hate it. Japan, Korea, Taiwan, obviously, Vietnam, India, not on particularly great terms with India either. There's a big territorial dispute there. So China has these kind of more immediate problems, as well potentially as some internal security problems and stability problems, which the U.S. hasn't faced. So on force, that's a bit of an issue. In terms of the other side, the institutional framework, this is another area where I have big questions about what China will do or what these BRICS countries will do together, because I don't really know if in the process of pushing for enlargement, China basically wants to use this as a jumping off point for pursuing more bilateral agreements. Now, previous experience would suggest that this is what they want to do, because that's how China prefers to do things, through all of these different bilateral deals. Now, in the short term, you can definitely see the case for this, because obviously, when it's just China and another country, China is very powerful and has a lot of leverage in those agreements, which is something you can see in the kinds of agreements they've struck with other countries bilaterally. However, again, if you go by a certain school of thought, which places a lot of priority on building these institutions as a framework for projecting your power in the long term, that is more of a problem. This would be, I mean, in international relations, the best known proponent of this would be, G. John Eikenberry, who kind of came up with this whole idea of strategic restraint. The idea that you basically build these institutions, you have rules, you kind of try at least some of the time to follow these rules. And in return, you basically get to institute your normative framework, and you give up a little bit, in return you gain a lot, and that's the kind of bargain.
Sounds like Germany and the EU.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to, Germany and the EU. I mean, it's the power of the little countries that actually come to force here, because if China wants to leverage its influence, it will have to rely on the benevolence of those countries. And as we've seen also with South Africa and India, well, India is not a small country, but it might eventually have different ideas what this is about, and also become a rival in certain markets of that. South Africa, we've also seen straightforward talk what to do about Putin. We're not being taken for granted. I don't think you can take them for granted as if they're just rallying behind China just because that's their big player. I mean, the other question I have is because it's so framed on the geopolitical politics of it, we have Russia, a war, and we have China's ambitions, how this will influence the infrastructure and the setup. If you have one belligerent actor amongst your main member, what does it mean and how well does it work? I mean, here again, I draw a parallel with the European Union. We started there in the 1950s and tried what can we do with Germany having actually waged a war against its neighbors, now to form a union. It was a bit of a trial error, and some of the projects and ambitions failed. It just couldn't be manifesting. We ended up with coal and steel as the starting point, which developed later on into something else. Now, it's not to say that the BRICS cannot do that. I mean, we live in one continent, so there's a close proximity. We're talking here about, with the BRICS, about an overspanning several continents with much more cultural diversity than we actually have. So maybe that makes it easier because you don't have to have a claim of cultural identity. We don't have to discuss that because it's per se not a given. So you might actually can focus on trade alone, while we Europeans as a continent, we very much more had the question of identity in our minds. What does it mean to be European? Maybe that's liberating. Maybe not. That's not. That's something I think would be interesting to watch what they're going to do with it.
Yeah, it was interesting when you wrote about Russia's invasion of Ukraine and how that was complicating this entire process. The example that actually came to mind for me was not so much the end of World War II, but was rather the Suez Crisis. Because that was a case in which obviously France and the UK, to put it mildly, went a little bit off piste. They basically colluded with Israel to try and invade Egypt to retake the Suez Canal. The US did not fancy starting World War III over Egypt and the Suez Canal. And so they basically told France and the UK to knock it off, and they knocked it off. And obviously, a lot of the way in which we look at the Suez Crisis now, especially from a European perspective, is that it was really like the end of the UK and France being major world powers. But at the same time, the flip side of that was the US being strong enough within the world order that it effectively created to also curtail its own allies. So as well as, I don't know, toppling governments in Iran or Chile or Guatemala or whatever, they were also in the position to say to their own junior partners effectively, don't do this, don't do that. With Russia and China over Ukraine, the dynamic there is clearly very different, where I don't know if China necessarily wanted to stop this or not, but it seems like even if they wanted to stop this, it wasn't really something they could do.
Yeah. Jack, you had a story this morning that pushed in a very similar direction, not on the BRICS, but on OPEC Plus. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the first thing, a little bit of background on OPEC Plus. Obviously, I'm sure a lot of our listeners know what OPEC is. They are basically a cartel of oil producing and exporting countries. They control, I think it is about 40% of global oil production and about 60% of oil exports. So very big, very powerful. OPEC Plus is OPEC, the original cartel, with several other countries, the biggest and most important of which is Russia. Now, OPEC Plus came about basically in the aftermath of a boom in oil production in the United States in the early 2010s. What effectively happened was that boom caused a massive global oil price war to ensue. That was very damaging for both Saudi Arabia and for Russia, and they decided that it was better to kind of join forces rather than to try and do this on their own. I'm simplifying quite a bit here, but that's the gist of it. Now, previously, that kind of, I guess you could say, marriage of convenience has been a little bit rocky, and Russia and Saudi Arabia kind of ended up in another price war effectively during the early stages of the pandemic. However, they've been trying over this process to work together on stabilizing the oil market in their interests. Now, the problem, as I see it, and I'm not the only one to see it this way, for Saudi Arabia and Russia within OPEC Plus are that at the moment, their interests are quite different. Saudi Arabia has a longer term goal of pivoting their economy away from reliance on oil and gas. So that is a goal which other countries in that region share. We can think about Bahrain and Qatar and the UAE, which have all variously pursued diversification programs. A lot of those diversification programs are quite further along than Saudi Arabia, who are still very reliant on oil for their budget revenues. So they have this plan, Vision 2030. It includes all sorts of, frankly, crazy stuff to try and diversify themselves from oil. But that plan is very expensive, and that means that they need oil prices to be nice and high to pay for that. Now, Russia's problem is basically a bit shorter term, which is that the war in Ukraine has massively increased spending for them. At the same time, sanctions have cut the revenue that they can receive from oil exports. So they're kind of in a position where they don't really want to sacrifice volume, as I interpret it, for the sake of, you know, losing revenue. So you have a situation at the moment where it kind of seems like they are not really going to deliver on the production cuts that they said they are going to deliver, which is then going to be a bit problematic. Now, it's not unheard of for countries in OPEC Plus to fail to meet their production quotas or targets. Angola and Nigeria have previously failed to meet production targets for almost the opposite reason, that they're simply not capable of ramping up their production to that level. So, but at the same time, this is a bit of a kind of structural problem. I think the problem within OPEC Plus and some of the difficulties that they are having at the moment speak to a wider issue within this attempt to get all of these countries together in some sort of anti-Western coalition, which is to say that there are like lots of countries that are effectively economically trying to do the same thing. You have big oil exporters who are, of course, unhappy with the West. They've always been unhappy with the West, and they always will be. Mm-hmm. You have other big commodities exporters like Brazil. Brazil are obviously unhappy with the status quo because the status quo isn't great for them as a country that relies on the export of raw materials and agricultural commodities. So, however, the problem at the same time is that when you do that, that often means that you're pulling across purposes. So one of the questions will have to be, how viable is this if we basically just have a bunch of commodities exporters in this group? And at that point, it almost becomes like a kind of just a block or an interest group rather than any kind of viable alternative global economic system. It's like the entire world can't export oil or soybeans.
In that sense, it would be interesting if Saudi Arabia would be admitted to the BRICS Plus consortium, because then that would open up more markets also and more possibilities to interact and extend their markets beyond oil. So they and Iran are both on the list, and other exporting countries. Maybe it's time to switch now to Germany, to Europe, go back to the Western world and actually go back to green transition, because it seems to be that in the West, we observe that our aspirations for the green technologies and for the Fit for 55 agenda becomes much more contentious on a political landscape than initially thought. So I think Germany is one of the first ones that experience such difficulties. Wolfgang, tell us more about it.
Yeah, Germany experienced the difficulties because they're further ahead in this, not so much in emissions cutting. Germany is actually lagging behind on this, but Germany is politically ahead of it because it has a Green Party in government. And not only does it have a Green Party in government, it is the Green Party in the second senior position of the government, and it has the ministry that matters, which is the Economics and Climate Change Ministry, and they basically churn out all the laws. Robert Habeck, the economics minister, is surrounded himself with friends. This itself has become a problem, but he's surrounded himself with this sort of green think tankers and green experts. This ministry is now fully in the hands of people who have spent their entire lives in opposition to the previous regime and who now have a chance to implement policies, and implement they do. Outside Germany, it was met with incomprehension that Germany would get rid of the nuclear power stations, but that was something that they would not compromise on. And the next piece of legislation is the domestic heating legislation, which is unbelievably radical because it forces homeowners to switch over the heating systems to heat pumps from 2024 onwards. Now, the interesting thing about this is that You know, the law doesn't say heat pumps. The law says, you know, it gives a target for the amount of renewable sources that is required for domestic heating systems. At the moment, only heat pumps do fulfill that settlement. So this is a case of pretending to be open to technological alternatives while basically foreclosing in on a single technology. That's pretty much the approach. One through regulations, through targets, and through a prejudicial early decision making on what the next technology is. Now, they have decided it's wind. 2% of the country is going to be plastered with windmills. It's going to be heat pumps for the domestic system. So they have basically pre-committed to a technological change, which is the opposite thing. Now, the political backlash that is happening is now that people previously, the interesting thing about green, everybody thought green is great. And, you know, they would say they would pay lip service to green. All the parties would pay lip service to green goals. But now that this thing is actually costing money and it is costing people money and it is, you know, it's entering the normal pace of politics where it has distributional impact and where reasonable people can oppose it because, you know, if you don't have the money for it, in some cases, the cost of the transition effects can be up to 50% of the value of a house. And if that is the case, it was perfectly normal that you would oppose a legislation that would essentially might even bankrupt you. Now, the government, there's going to be some changes and the discussions going on right now in the parliament. The law will be, some of the edges will come off. There will be subsidies, but it's difficult to subsidize something of that nature on that scale because we kind of blew our subsidies on the pandemic and the energy subsidies. So there isn't an awful lot of scope left. So this is becoming serious. Now, the Greens are free-falling in the polls. If now they're now at 13-14%, they were at 20-22% at one point, not too long ago. They are back to where they were at the last elections, which is really their core support. Now, the elections result wasn't that great. It was enough for them to get into power, but it wasn't that great. The AfD is now coming up fast in the polls. It's now hit 18%, not only on the polls that register these swings early, but even now on these sort of more established polls that tend to be based on a much more solid methodology. So 18% for the AfD is massive. I've always said their potential in the country is for 30%. That's if FDP and CDU turn to the center of the political spectrum, not pursue conservative policies and nationalist policies. And the CDU is kind of wavering at the moment. It was certainly in that direction under Angela Merkel. The FDP is associated with all the green policies. So the AfD has a wonderful, it's basically the only party on the right that can benefit from this general unhappiness. So there's normalization going on. And I think what we're observing is the CDU, CSU, the main center-right opposition, is now starting to shift its policies on green. And, you know, it's been calling for an end of a regulatory pause in Brussels. It has opposed the environmental protection legislation, the sort of the Nature Reserve Directive of the European Commission. And so there is now a beginning of a backlash against Greens with very serious political consequences in the long run, because, you know, previously, until not very recently, we talked about CDU Green coalitions, about Jamaica coalitions, as we called them after the party card. All that's gone now because the CDU and the Greens are the opposing forces in German politics. The SPD is sort of, you know, can probably coalesce with anyone now, but the Greens and the CDU are the protagonists, the main protagonists in the battle. And that vastly reduces centrist coalition options. I mean, I was just doing the maths on the German one. If you want to avoid another grand coalition, which I think everybody does because, it, you know, after 16 years of Angela Merkel, people are kind of fed up with this. Only coalition option, power option the CDU now has is the one it has always said it will not do, which is having a coalition with the AfD. Now, for now, that's not on the cards, but I can just add one and one together because a party wants to get into power eventually and it cannot foreclose the only realistic power option that it has. So eventually this will go and we will have in Germany what we have in other countries where the far right is suddenly becoming either a, you've seen this in Sweden where there's a conference of supply agreement with the center-right coalition. In Finland, there's now talks going on with the Finns party. So in Austria, this has happened a long time ago. It won't be quite like Italy, where the far right is the leader of this coalition. But anyway, the German far right is very different from the Fratelli d'Italia. This is a very different beast.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, they're kind of the AfD are extremely different, right?
Neo-Nazis.
No, they do. They make Giorgio Meloni look like Comrade Adenauer. That's the only way to describe it. But one of the things I think about too for this is what it is going to mean for the wider trajectory of the green transition. Like, The thing is that regardless of what you do, climate change is going to continue happening, right? Or rather, if you stop doing this, climate change is going to continue happening. And as it does, the effects are going to worsen. And that is going to mean that it is going to be an issue of increased political salience. If people think that having to install a heat pump is going to reduce their home value, wait until they realize what being in a flood zone and having your house become uninsurable does to your home value. These impacts of climate change are going to start having a more material effect on people's lives. And that will, in turn, influence the conversation around this politically. The problem then that you get to is once you've wasted, I don't know, the better part of half a decade squabbling about this, and then you get to this point, you get to a point where it's like, okay, now we have to try and like rush things, and that is just going to make it much messier. So like, for instance, on the conversation about technological neutrality, the counter argument to the idea would be that kind of governments do have to actually pre-build a lot of different things and plan ahead. And to a certain extent, you kind of need to know what solution you're going forward with. Like as a simple example, for instance, how much do you invest in grid infrastructure? Like if you were going to say, okay, well, we try to do this with hydrogen versus we try to do this using electricity, that has different implications for the kind of infrastructure that you fund. And to a great extent, the state is going to need to fund those things regardless, right? I don't think you can really have necessarily private sector actors building out entire grid transmission systems by themselves. And these are kind of things where you will need to think ahead. Not something where we can say, okay, well, we're just going to, you know, snap our fingers and increase the renewable energy, because that renewable energy needs to get from point A to point B.
Regulatory uncertainty is one of the biggest obstacles for investment as well.
Especially in Europe, it's an absolute nightmare for these people, right? You know, like if you look at what firms in the energy sector say about the biggest barriers, I mean,
It's everywhere. You have it in Lebanon, you have it in the Middle East, as long as you don't have any clear commitment. I mean, in that sense, it's interesting what Saudi Arabia, its plan is actually coming up to. They want to build the biggest green and blue hydrogen plant, like 350 kilometers, square kilometers for exporting hydrogen to the region and abroad. So there is a clear plan whether this is really feasible by 2026, as they say. So that's another matter. But at least there's a commitment to become that big leading force in the Middle East on renewable energies. We haven't seen that sort of same dedication here in Europe. And also, I think if you compare, for example, France and France's way of going about to Germany with the regulation saying this is the energy source you need to use. So it's dictating the consumer what to do. Whereas France is trying to get to nudge them. They are now in talks with banks because they want the banks to dedicate certain loans and allow people to take loans for their greenhouse renovations, which include thermal isolations and new boilers and or new forms of green energy sources, and to allow the payback of the capital as well as the interest payment to come into force only when the house is sold.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting point that you're making there, because it shows, I mean, Jack, you're right, your macro argument is right, that we all face climate change and there is a cost. What is different now is that it has distributional impacts. Now, if I live in a flood zone, then I will be hit by climate change. But if I, you know, if I'm somebody who does not live in a flood zone and yet have a house with a lower value, I'm disproportionately affected by the heat pump action compared to somebody who has a large home in a floodplain. For that person, it is absolutely sensible to have a macro climate change agenda. So that's the point I'm making. I'm not saying that we shouldn't make these changes or these changes shouldn't happen. What the point I was making is the reason why politics is now intruding is because it has now, for the first time, distributional impact, whereas previously it was all about aspiration. It was about people were favoring green agenda points because it looked good, it sounded good. Everybody was in favor of this, and this is not the case anymore. If you look at the way the Germans are trying to fund this, as opposed to the French, who are much more sensible about this is a poll tax. If you do look at this economically, the obligation to force everybody to invest like 20 to 50,000 euros in a heat pump, irrespective of their wealth and their income, is a poll tax. It's exactly the same thing. And we all know what happened to any rulers who imposed poll taxes on their citizens. And if you go back in the UK, where Thatcher fell over this ultimately, you know, there were sensible reasons for that. It wasn't like it was totally out of the order, but the argument against it and the argument that also prevailed was that backlash against this is so strong that it is something one shouldn't consider. Just my second point, I'll make it briefly, it's about a technological commitment. I completely agree about grids. But for example, if you take the example of nuclear power, I mean, the Americans have a different strategy. They keep their existing systems, and they kind of wait for the day when they have the big solution, which is fusion. That can be decades away, but it's the question then is, should we overinvest into renewable sources, and which is costly and also has problems of its own with intermittency and all these other issues, or should we actually keep doing what we are doing now with maybe more nuclear with better technologies until we get the best possible solution, which is fusion? Or on the cars, for example, the EU has decided to phase out fuel-driven cars by 2035 with only the smallest exemptions, but without securing the supplies of lithium and batteries, etc. So this is actually also a geopolitical risk that we're taking, that we have basically made a regulatory change on the environmental side that might make us geostrategically much more vulnerable. Would it have not been more sensible, instead of doing that, going, because the Euro 7 norm for cars, and sorry about getting a little bit sort of technical on this stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the Euro 7, we come on to Euro 7.
The Euro 7 is gone, basically, now. They finished it because nobody has, you know, the reason why it's gone is because it cannot at the same time phase out a technology and ask companies to invest in making the phased out technologies even better so that they fulfill higher and higher norms, because the car companies put all their money now in making up for the lost time they wasted by not investing into next generation technologies. So the alternative would have been forget the 2035 target, but actually push through with a Euro 7 norm target. This would have significantly reduced gas emissions and wait until a winning technology emerges, and it may well be hydrogen. We don't know that yet, and you know, experts are in disagreement. And as I'm not an expert, I merely state that experts are in disagreement. I don't want to prejudge this. Therefore, there are alternative strategies, but for certain things, I completely agree. We have to pre-commit in order to invest to create a framework for investment. That is a powerful argument. I don't want to knock this, but we have gone the extreme other way, and that is different from the United States. There are not just two ways. There are different shades. It's a non-binary situation.
Yeah, I mean, there's a blend, obviously, but and I think this comes back to part of the problem is that to find that blend also means making profound changes to the way that you do things in terms of economy, in terms of your industrial policy, in terms of your politics. And I think if we were almost going to sum up why these problems have started occurring now, one of the big ones was that there was not enough communication about how much of a shift this would require. Like a lot of the discussion around environmental stewardship seemed to be like, oh, you can just do things like, I don't know, recycle or use plastic straws or whatever, you know, avoid using plastic straws rather or whatever. It was all this like small stuff at the individual level that people would do and there was a lot of talk about that, but it's like, no, actually, this is going to mean completely retooling our economies. This is a pretty much another industrial revolution is what this is going to require. And I don't think politicians were ever as forthcoming as they should have been, well, for the most part, about the scale of this. Now, I think, especially in the US, there's been a lot more discussion about that level of scale and what that's going to mean, and more acceptance that this is going to mean profound changes for the way that the economy works. And as that happens, naturally, that is going to move into discussions around an entirely different set of political questions.
That's absolutely right. In Europe, we have the experience where politicians pick winners on technological winners. I had a little fun with Helmut Kohl and François Mitterrand's HDTV episode. I mean, older readers may, or viewers or listeners may remember that was in the late 80s and early 1990s. France and Germany pioneered a new analog television standard. If you read the literature about this thing, I mean, this is, at the time, television was hugely complicated because, you know, we still have the Eurovision Song Contest as a sort of remnant of that era. But it was the time when national TV companies cooperated and they had a European framework group, and all the satellite stuff that was emerging at the time was kind of being developed in those days. And they were all in disagreement on the technology. In many respects, very similar to what we have today about the discussion on energy, future energy sources. And I do remember as an American author who basically sort of intervened in this debate and said, look, I mean, you know, whether you want to have this HDTV standard or that HDTV, you will probably find that fast developing digital technology in the early 90s, would eventually sort this out. And it would settle on a standard that that neither of you are even envisaging at the moment, which is, of course, exactly what happened. The analog HDTV ended, but it was not foreseeable because Kohl and Mitterrand thought the EU needed to do something that give benefit to consumers. And since they saw their average voter as a television viewer, that was the thing that they thought that was the greatest thing the EU could ever do, give them a really nice television image. It's ridiculous from today's perspective when, you know, images are better than we need. But in those days, it was a powerful argument but also a demonstration of how the most plausible ideas at the time, supported by scientists. You know, there were many experts who agreed with Kohl that Kohl and Mitterrand were not just, you know, lone voices in this. How they get this wrong. And that's why, you know, I would always plead for a degree of technological openness, because, you know, the wind, extreme reliance on wind in Germany, for example, may not be the wisest course of action from the perspective of 2035 or 2040.
It's difficult to tell, right? Because at the same time, wind is kind of what we have now. And I think with fusion, obviously, the technology is very exciting and it could become very important later on. But for understandable reasons, I think a lot of people are quite jaded with fusion at the moment. That's going to be there are, of course, good reasons for being optimistic about it, but it's a very difficult argument to win socially or politically.
People were jaded with digital in the early 90s too. So we don't know the future. I don't know it either. And a good way to end this podcast. Thank you for listening. Until next week.